I'm going to start by one of the things we're doing today is allowing a lot of different talks to kind of layer over each other. So we'll reiterate in slightly different ways the same. We'll keep coming back to the same themes, but I think I have a slightly different answer to your question, because I think from our perspective, and it comes back to a kind of Daiwo ethos. It's maybe not different, but just another layer, is that I think core to our understanding of the value of the commons is as an ongoing process of negotiation by diverse interests about the production, renewal and sustainability of resources. So it's this process of expecting those who have an interest in a resource to be part of both the production and the decision about how it's managed. And our encounter with networks and as the web as it started with the thing that gave us the sense that we now had an opportunity to see ourselves together in a new way, and that we had tools to see ourselves together over distance and across difference. And that's a very nice segue for me into what I'm now going to talk about. So what I'm going to talk about is the impact, the possible impact of new developments in network technology, especially the blockchain. Could you put your hands up if you have heard of the blockchain? Okay, so that's about half of the people in the room. Could you put your hand up if you've heard of Bitcoin? Okay, good. That gives me a good starting point. Now, the premise of this talk is that blockchain and the Bitcoin is going to be a very important technology, and that we all need to be getting in the middle of it. To come back to the question of diversity, we need to be shaping this technology. One of the wonderful things about the early web was that non-tech experts could put together an HTML page, put it onto a computer, and then find themselves connected with the people on the other side of the world. So it put us in conversation with people who were different from ourselves. That was the web, maybe starting 20, 25 years ago. And so what I'm going to talk about is just how some of the material makeup of the blockchain, how this is being taken up by culture, some of the similarities it has with the early web, why artists are getting in the middle of it, and why we think it's important that artists get in the middle of it. I'm just starting with this, just so we're going to be doing the history thing. This is called a simple net art diagram. It was made in 1997 by NTAA, a New York artist duo. And this is a kind of joke about, it was making a connection between the kind of spirit of early net art, so artists who were making work for the web and for networks, in that it was kind of making a connection of Fluxus practice, with this idea that the art happens between us. The value of art is vested in an object or a place. It's vested in somewhere between the transmission and reception of what happens between an artist and audience, or between the audiences in a kind of participatory process. And their joke is to kind of put computers in the place of people. You'll see me very elegantly bookend this talk with the new one at the end, so you can all look forward to that. Back in August last year, or September, we launched a new program called Art, Data, Money. And we put out a kind of bold call. So we said, join us to build commons for the arts in the networked age. In particular, we were inviting people to help us think through how emerging developments in big data and the blockchain. So the blockchain is the technology that underpins Bitcoin, and I'm going to describe a little bit more about that in a minute. But how these things might help us to possibly develop new economies, but also how they might help us to build solidarity and to engage in this process of negotiating a kind of common culture for the good of us all. One of the things that we find necessary to do at Fernfield, because we are working with arts, technology and social change, which the technology field moves ever faster. And so in order to keep up with where things are at, sometimes we put out a very bold statement and then wait for a lot of very smart people to tell us why we're wrong. But then we're in a conversation with them. And then we're having an interesting conversation about what things don't work and how we might put it better next time, and about whether they might be interested in coming and helping us do this. And this is what this programme, this is what this kind of call was intended to do. And the programme's kicked off and we're running labs, and we have a whole series of things, and we're working with lots of people, so activists, finance specialists, people in law, to help us to understand and make this field more legible and feelable to more diverse people, and this feels very important. In September, we opened a show called The Human Face of Crypto Economies, never afraid of a difficult title, and we're really, so here we are in the middle of a North London park, very diverse community, and people are interested. They like to be addressed on contemporary questions, as long as they are welcomed and everyone's and we're prepared to have a conversation with them. And this is work by Emily Brew and Maxine Marion that we've here, called Golden Glitter. So the show is a mixture of kind of works that took a kind of rhetorical or poetical engagement with ideas and the function of money in our society, but also started to look at the relationship between art, digital culture and value. So I'm going to talk very briefly about this work by Rob Myers. So Rob Myers is an artist and a developer. He's currently working for the Creative Commons Foundation. And this work was called Shareable Renegades. And what he did was that he took three iconic artworks, so Coons' Balloon Dog, the urinal, and Greet's Not a Pipe, and made 3D models of them and published the models online, so you could take the 3D models, you could change them, so right slap bang in the middle of the kind of free and open source software culture, this idea that you can take the code, you can remake it, you can shape it, and as long as you share the code, you can do what you like with it. So he put these models online and then invited people to download them, they could buy their own artwork. And what we did as part of this show was that we said, yes, you can go and buy your own, you can order your own 3D printed version of this artwork for £23, or you can buy it from us for £300, in which case you will get it with a certificate of inauthenticity signed by the artist. And this is a kind of play on the value that the art world brings to objects. It's got lots of jokes in it, which we like. But the reason I'm spending some time talking about this is because sometimes it's easy for artworks that are made using digital media or digital material for it to end up looking like a bit of a demonstration of technology, or possibly something which just looks faster, slicker, brighter, stronger. And for us to forget that there is this whole layer of work that is going on that is very careful conceptual work that is, it's rooting itself in art culture. The other reason I'm showing this is because Rob has really informed our thinking and is part of the reason he kick-started this process in engaging with the blockchain. And this work is called Facecoin. I'm not going to tell you about it because I have to explain to you first about Bitcoin. But I'm going to tell you about this, and you need to go and have a look at it, because once you have a better sense of why Bitcoin is interesting, this will really make a lot of sense to you. But we showed this in our exhibition, and it gave us a way to have a conversation with people, to keep them with us for 5 minutes, because it's interesting to look at, which was how long it took us to kind of explain what there was that was of interest about blockchain and Bitcoin. Okay, so I don't know if you recognise this image. This is how we are made to feel as we encounter blockchain technology. You know, this is from 2001, as the apes encounter the monolith, and like, what is this? This is going to change our world. We don't know what it is. Let's shake a stone at it, shake a bone at it. And there's an enormous, as there was in the web, although I wasn't so attuned to it then, I'm really attuned to it now, there's an enormous amount of kind of hype and rhetoric surrounding the emergence of blockchain technology. And I did hear someone, currently in the blockchain community, you can see an awful lot of rhetoric surrounding how blockchain is going to present us with a new paradigm of democracy. We're all going to be liberated from government and world banks by it. And when you go and meet, when I've been to meetups with people who are involved in this technology, I actually heard someone give us their kind of statement before they left the stage. Their statement was, "We can make finance great again." Woo! And everyone was like, I was thinking, how does this match up? Okay, so now I'm going to tell you a few factual things, I hope. Greta, you'll give me a loud 5-minute warning, won't you? Okay, so this is a little history, because I think it's helpful to think in this way about it. It's a bit like me trying to describe what email was in 1980. Okay. What impact email might have in 1980? So, computers store information in a database, and a set of softwares manipulate and move this information around. That's what computers are. The internet gave us a network of computers. Okay, so they're now sharing information, and their softwares are interacting with each other, and it's all getting a bit more complicated. 1991, the web gave us a way to access data on the network of computers around the world, so we could now reach into computers around the world. Then in the early noughties, we had peer-to-peer technology, so like torrents, where we could start to do file sharing on a global scale. 1999, we have mobile technologies, which means that we're starting to carry these things around, and that they're kind of living among us. It's that they're much more involved in, they're in the nooks and crannies of our lives more. 2008, with the collapse of the banks, Bitcoin makes its appearance. So this is a digital currency. And it provides a secure, anonymous and transparent way to record out all transactions to a decentralized global database. You'll have heard of Silk Road. Some of you will have heard of Silk Road. So this is kind of dark website. And so some of the hype surrounding Bitcoin is that it allowed people to trade illegal things and order assassinations. I don't think it's ever been proven that that happened, but there were stories and myths going around. And then in 2003, people started to realise more about blockchain, that blockchain was the software that underpinned Bitcoin, and to think about what we might do with this. One of the problems, I don't know, I might be making assumptions, one of the problems I certainly have in thinking about blockchain and Bitcoin is that I read things like, it's a way to record all transactions to a decentralized database, and I'm asleep by the time I get to the end of the sentence. It's really hard to make it interesting. And this is why we think it's important that artists get in the middle of this, because we need to have a way to kind of actually think through some of what this means. Okay, I'm not going to show that slide just yet. So I'm going to say this just in a different way. So what Bitcoin and blockchain do is, at the moment, most global currency, anyone can shout and disagree with me if I'm being slightly inaccurate at any point. Okay, so I'm doing my best to be accurate, but it's hard. Okay, so the world banks hold databases of all the transactions that are made, financial transactions that are made globally. They're gathered at a ground level and they move up this hierarchy to the World Banks, and at the end of each, maybe four or five times a day, all the World Banks compare their databases and say, yes, we agree, this is where the money is sitting. So there's this kind of hierarchical process of the World Banks hold these transactions on databases, otherwise called ledgers. And it's a historic reason why we've come to this point. Now, what Bitcoin does after the world collapsed, the World Banks, is complaints around who was controlling this money and why governments come and then bail out the banks and in whose interest that is. What Bitcoin does is say, okay, we're going to have our own database, and we're going to share the database, and we're going to share the responsibility for verifying and for maintaining that database. And in order to do the work of maintaining the database, we're going to mine coins, and whoever does the work of maintaining the database gets some of those coins. Okay, that's fundamentally what the blockchain does. It has a database, it's a software that allows this database to sit on many different computers, and what blockchain does is allow us to say, yes, what's true here is also true there. The way it does that is that it spits out, so the software, blockchain software, spits out a really difficult problem. At the moment it's about once every 10 to 12 minutes, a really difficult problem, and mining is just solving a difficult problem. And whoever solves the difficult problem wins the Bitcoin. And so it's a kind of, you get paid for doing the work of maintaining the ledger. So it's a kind of commons. You can see why people can think about this as a very kind of exciting development in a bank for the people, by the people. If you're anything like me, your mind will start to slip around a little bit around this stuff because it's quite confusing. I'm just going to show you a picture. So this is what I've just been talking about. So the database is constantly gathering information about the latest transactions. The software spits out a problem. Hundreds of thousands of transactions happen. The problem is solved, and all of those transactions find themselves on a block. That is a block. A block is what happens between one problem being solved and another problem being solved in the database. This is a blockchain mining rig. These are really hot. This actually belongs to Ben Vickers, who we've been working with. He's a digital curator of digital at Serpentine. And we have a shared interest in artistic self-organisation. So we kind of come together and we're gathering other people to us to kind of think about this thing. This is his mining rig. So you can kind of do it yourself. He's a little bit more techie than I, but I'm fairly sure that I could probably get this thing working. But it uses a lot of electricity. And this one's actually mining Ethereum, which is second round blockchain, which I'm going to come to next. How long do I have? Okay. You can't see that, but the main message is, this is a blockchain that existed in 2016. About 90% of the 90% of the logos on here are to do with finance and banking. So currently, the ecosystem is heavily occupied by the finance industry. I think a lot of the people who we've been talking to think that this is a problem. So while it was set up, while it was inspired as a kind of move against the hegemony of global banking systems, actually this system that has been produced actually serves the interbank processes extremely well. And they're currently sucking up all the developers, and this is why at that meeting of developers, someone could say, we can make finance great, and everyone knew what they meant by that. Okay, so I was talking about Ethereum, the second layer. So this is a lot of concepts, but
you won't ever have to hear this again, and next time you read people talking about this, it'll make just a little bit more sense. So, Bitcoin to blockchain 2. This is like the move from the web before social media to the web. So this is now blockchain with the starts, the seeds of Facebook. So this is actually the time when people beyond the real geeks move into the blockchain, and then it starts to be useful. And I just need to, I've put this concisely somewhere, and I think that would be helpful. So, DAOs. No one can quite find what the D stands for at the moment, but this is a mixture of technical description and hype. Decentralized, distributed, democratic. And then autonomous organizations. So these are the kind of next layer. These are opt-in smart contracts. So just imagine a contract or a constitution which has executable code on that sits on the blockchain, through which decisions and actions are automated according to agreed terms. So what this is doing is... Actually, no, I'm going to give you an example because it's too many things to think about at once. So I'm going to give you some examples so you can get a sense of what this means. What we have, what Rob Myers observed, and he put out a white paper called DAOWO, so this was the DAO combined with DAIWO, was that there was a split between the kind of right libertarian, we can all be free of central banks, governments, taxation, international law and regulation, on one hand, and then the kind of left-leaning artists who have a sense of another world being possible, but possibly with a more mutualist bent. And the idea being, so if we all share the ledger, then we don't need central banks anymore, and we're all creating our own money. But the smart contracts means that we can start to contract globally without the need for law and without taxation getting in the way. Obviously, this just all happens in another layer. And I've heard people talk in a way that I just don't really understand, with great enthusiasm about the kind of doing away with all international law and regulation. So a lot of the conversation in this community at the moment is around this tension of the need for governance, the need for policy, the need for a Hippocratic oath for developers working in this field, and then just a real kind of free-for-all, a sense of total free market, everything monetized. What? How could the world be better than a free market, fully monetized set of transactions? I was gonna give you some examples, but I think I might just start with, I might just end with why it's important that the arts engage with blockchain. Artists make good canaries. They're good at sensing when things are getting dangerous, and that's useful. It's also important for arts and culture to engage with the blockchain, just because business and banking is really moving. They are really moving in, and because new technologies reflect the values and interests of those who create them. It's really important that there are more diverse people shaping this space. And I think the Industrial Revolution showed us that we really need to pay attention to the values and the kind of limits and freedoms that we bake into our societies when we roll out new technical infrastructures. And if you look at how blockchain technologies are working, the things that happen now are really going to have a massive effect on what happens in relation to what things get automated, what this does to our subjectivities, its possible impacts on surveillance and the monitoring of our everyday actions, that we kind of just really need to wake up to, I think. And I said I would, so I will. Look at all these slides you're not going to hear about. Change everything forever. Yes, that's... So at some point, this might have been exciting to me. Now I'm just in a state of, like, horror. Okay, change everything forever. But this is kind of the part of the rhetoric and the threat and the polemic surrounding blockchain. And Rob Myers made. So you'll remember the first diagram. So whereas before it was a kind of quite an open image, the simple net art diagram between two beings, here we are. Now we're in a line of history. The art happens here. So I think there's a kind of ominous feeling to this, also still quite humorous, but a sense that we're kind of starting to be, you know, we're being pushed into the machine. So I'll just finish by saying that the work that we're doing at the moment, we're working on a short film where we're having people, both blockchain developers and people from different areas, thinking about how the world will look different because of the blockchain. We're producing a book called Artists Rethinking the Blockchain and working with some fiction writers and artists and theorists, but people experts in money and law and kind of commons culture. And we're looking at setting up a series of workshops where we can start to develop our own decentralized autonomous organizations for self-organizing artists. And we were having a drink in the pub the other night and thinking about possibly setting up a kind of mutualist organization where you might, for instance, so this is just to help you think about what this might possibly be. So perhaps artists who are working in higher education, or those people who have a more kind of precarious but maybe working in across residencies or exhibitions with the dribs and drabs of income, or people from kind of diverse backgrounds coming together and saying, yes, okay, I'm now going to dedicate 20% of my income to this group of people, and that you can set up the rules and the values whereby the work that you do will be jointly promoted. You have shared values baked into the constitution, and you also have a way to possibly lock yourselves into a kind of loyalty ring by joining forces through a contract. I've said it. I'm not at all keen on it, but these are the kinds of things that people are talking about. I don't know if I'm keen on it. We just need to talk about it more and kind of work out what might be there. That's it.